Welcome to this summer solstice longest day of the year, Forthright Radio for June 21st, 2017. I'm Joy LeClaire. We have a very full show for you today. Our guest today is Professor Gar Alperovitz, and we'll be speaking with him about the work of the Democracy Collaborative, which he co-founded, and their document, which you can read for free online, Principles of a Pluralist Commonwealth. He seeks to answer these questions. If the design of corporate capitalism is unable to sustain values of equality, genuine democracy, liberty, and ecological sustainability as a matter of inherent systemic architecture, what systemic design might ultimately achieve and sustain these values? And how specifically might it be possible to move forward, especially in difficult political times, to lay foundations for a transformation in the direction of a serious new systemic answer? But before we ask him what answers he has explored to these questions, we take a moment to remember the passing earlier this month of Father Miguel Descoto Brockman, the Nicaraguan Maronil priest and practitioner of liberation theology, who was his country's foreign minister under the Sandinista government during the 1980s. He was elected to head the United Nations General Assembly just before Israel's Operation Cast Lead began, which resulted in the deaths of over 1,000 in Gaza, more than a third of whom were children. In his defense of Palestine through those weeks of war, and in his later commitment to forcing the UN to take environmental justice seriously, he aimed to transform the General Assembly into a potent force for global justice. His wisdom and perseverance in the pursuit of justice from a place of love serve as a beacon in a world too often bent on mindless destruction. To honor him, we share this poignant song written by Nicaraguan songwriter Luis Mejia Godoy, based on a poem by Nicaraguan revolutionary Tomas Borges, co-founder of the SNLF, the Sandinista National Liberation Front, who had been brutally tortured during the Somoza regime. It's called My Personal Revenge, here performed by Jackson Brown.
My personal revenge will be the right of our children in the schools and in the gardens. My personal revenge will be to give you this song which has flourished without panic. My personal revenge will be to show you the kindness in the eyes of my people, who have always fought relentlessly in battle and been generous and firm in victory. My personal revenge will be to tell you good morning on a street without beggars or homeless, but instead of jailing you, I suggest you shake away the sadness there that blinds you. And when you who have applied your hands in torture are unable to look up at what surrounds you, my personal revenge will be to give you these hands that once you so mistreated but have failed to take away their tenderness. It was the people who hated you the most when rage became the language of their song. And underneath the skin of this town today, its heart has been scarred forevermore. Thank you. skin of this town today. Its heart has been scarred forevermore. And underneath the skin of this town today, red and black, its heart's been scarred forevermore.
Father Miguel Descoto Brockman, presente. And now, on to our interview with today's guest, Professor Gar Alperovitz, who has had a distinguished career as an historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official. He is a professor emeritus of political economy at the University of Maryland, as well as a former fellow of King's College, Cambridge University, Harvard's Institute of Politics, the Institute for Policy Studies, and the Brookings Institution. He is the author of books on the atomic bomb and atomic diplomacy, the decision to use the atomic bomb and the architecture of an American myth, as well as other books such as What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution and America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. Gar Alperovitz is the president of the National Center for Economic and Security Alternatives, and he is a co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative, a research institution developing practical, policy-focused, and systematic paths towards ecologically sustainable, community-oriented change and the democratization of wealth. He is also the co-chair of the Next System Project, a project of the Democracy Collaborative. I began by asking him about the Next System Project and their document, Principles of a Pluralist Commonwealth. Good morning, Professor Alperovitz. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Glad to be with you. Thanks for having me.
We're going to be focusing on your Next System Project and the document, Principles of a Pluralist Commonwealth. Could you please explain what is meant by a pluralist commonwealth and what are the structural principles that it requires?
The classical kind of divisions have been that what we face is either state socialism or corporate capitalism. And the argument both of the Next System Project and of this little book, Principles of a Pluralist Commonwealth, which, by the way, is available free online. We can talk about that later. The argument is that there are ways to think about changing the system that go well beyond that, starting in communities at the local level, building up to decentralized forms at the state level, regional development, models that, in fact, begin with very American things like cooperatives and worker-owned companies and municipal energy and municipal and neighborhood cable, all of which are democratic ownership forms, plural forms, lots of different forms, and you can build your way up to a system that is both democratic but also changes the ownership of wealth to a democratic form rather than the extreme elite and corporate concentrations we have now, and also rather than state socialism, which concentrated it all in the hands of the state. So those are the principles involved, and we go into detail both in the Next System Project, which explores many variations on this theme, and in this little book that I've just published, Pluralist Commonwealth, which is my particular way of thinking about it, and including all lots and lots of specific things going on around the country.
As you mentioned, it is an American thing, even though it appears in our current situation to be rather radical. I came up with a quote from, of all people, John Winthrop of Pilgrim fame in his essay, or actually it was a sermon, A Model of Christian Charity, which some may have remembered from Ronald Reagan's excerpt, City on the Hill. But there's another quote, and this is it. We must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always having before our eyes commission and community in the work, our community as members of the same body. And I was flabbergasted to get that quote in light of your piece on pluralist commonwealth. And of course, Massachusetts Bay Colony was called a commonwealth. Let's go into what that means, commonwealth.
Well, that's a wonderful quote, and I'm glad to hear of it. And please send it to me, or I'll look it up in Winthrop's speech. That's perfect. Because let me say, one of the principles of the pluralist commonwealth is to build community from the bottom up, in a real sense, both structural and involvement. So that is the way people relate to each other. And it asks, what are the economic conditions that now drive us apart, and what might be structures that bring us together? I mean, the most obvious and common one, and there are many, many more, but the simplest one people know about is the simple cooperative, which is a slightly different, has a little bit communitarian flavor, but there are many more things beyond that. In any case, the book begins to look at them from the bottom up and tries to piece together things that are going on around the country, by the way, not things that are abstract or simply theory. Every bit of what we're looking at has some analog and that somebody's doing someplace that the people can do where they are. And that's one of the big points of the book.
You describe this current period in which we find our lives as, quote, the prehistory of potentially transformative and fundamental change, end quote, and that it's important to study and understand other prehistories to guide us now. Tell us about that. What are some examples of these prehistories, and what in particular should we be paying attention to now?
I'm a historian as well as a political economist, so I always think in these longer terms. Notice what Bernie Sanders did in the last election. Had he won the Democratic nominee, very well have had a different flavor of government. So it's not simply that there is no alternative out there, and there are lots of things on the ground now. By prehistory, I mean that things develop slowly before they hit the national headlines. It's a necessary process that things have to build up, and indeed a lot of the things discussed in this little book, Principles, reports on what's going on that the national media doesn't cover. But here are some examples just to answer your question directly. If you look at the history of the civil rights movement, the civil rights movement can be traced back easily to the 1930s. And some of my real heroes are the people who were working in obscurity in Mississippi under great, great danger in the 1930s and 40s, laying groundwork quietly for things that only exploded in the 1960s. Same can be said of the feminist movement. If you actually look at the development slowly, piece by piece after World War II, before the 1960s, in a certain way, the work done in the prehistory, before it explodes, is much harder and in some ways much more important. And I take my hats off to people who really struggle that way. And the same can be said of the environmental movement. Oddly enough, the conservative movement was obscure in the 1940s. And it had to build up to what it became the Reagan era as well. So this is a well-known process of people who are working prior to what becomes in the news, I think are the most important folks doing work, because it's so hard to do, but it's absolutely essential to establishing the next stage. And virtually everything discussed in this little book, for instance, cooperatives are popping up all over the country, taking over utilities. In Boulder, folks have taken over the public utility for climate change reasons. In Colorado, they've been establishing community-owned cable television. In many, many parts of the country, worker co-ops are developing. All sorts of things that are very practical that anybody can do if they want to roll up their sleeves. Our website kind of lead you to a lot of practical things, but the book also gives you access to different things going on around the country. It's not just a theory book. It's in each case giving examples of what people are already doing now around the country or could be doing.
We're speaking with Gar Alperovitz. He is a mega thinker, in my opinion, of transformative economics. And he has worked on a collaborative called the Democracy Collaborative. Why don't you take just a moment and speak about that? Am I correct that the Next System Project came out of the Democracy Collaborative?
The Next System Project, yes, is a project of the Democracy Collaborative, but in a different sense, the idea of building and laying groundwork for a transformative next system has always been the main point of the Democracy Collaborative, although the main focus of the Democracy Collaborative, practically speaking, has been in communities and working with cooperatives, in complex cooperatives and local land development. So it's primarily focused at the local level. And the Next System Project is an explicit decision to move to both the local, state, and national level as well, although it's been part of the idea all along.
How long has the Democracy Collaborative been around?
In its current form, I think we're just at about year number 20 now. I think that we're in our 20th year. We were in the University of Maryland when I was a professor there, and then when I moved on, we set it up as an external, freestanding nonprofit organization. It has predecessors, which were called the Exploratory Project for Economic Alternatives, was a predecessor which I was involved with setting up, and the National Center for Economic Alternatives, pretty much all doing the same thing, and then finally took on its final form as the Democracy Collaborative over, maybe 30 years of development.
Listeners can go to either the Democracy Collaborative or the Next System Project. Just Google either of those two things, and you will eventually get to their document that we're discussing today, Principles of a Pluralist Commonwealth, which is free to read online. One of the very first things that you discuss is the challenge of global climate change. And although you don't go into it specifically in the Next System Project, elsewhere you've talked about a very intriguing idea of buying out the fossil fuel companies. Could you talk about that, please?
It's a combination of things that are developing very fast in the world of monetary theory and banking, which sounds kind of really abstract, but it's getting very practical, both here and in Great Britain. Under the Labour Party almost won this election, and they've been developing very similar ideas. So here's how it goes. You almost always, we know this from big landholders in Latin America and elsewhere, you almost always have to buy them out to get them out of the way. And the big fossil fuel companies are under severe pressure, including from the Securities and Exchange Commission, because many, many people think they cannot actually ultimately get the oil out of the ground because pressure is building up around the world. So the value of their stock is a very, very dubious and questionable thing. The SEC has been challenging Exxon, says it's overvaluing its stock because it's not taking a look down the line when they may lose the value of all these oil reserves they have. So the oil companies are in a much more shaky position than most people realize financially in terms of their futures. They look very powerful, but if the climate change movement around the world continues to build up, they're going to have some trouble. So they may not be as strong. That's one side of it. The other side is something in banking theory, which again sounds very ominous. It's called, in the modern term, is quantitative easing. That's what the Federal Reserve Board uses that term. What's happening in the economics profession is something called modern monetary theory. And it goes like this. Anytime we actually get into a big war, there doesn't seem to be any problem about raising the money, financing it. The banks are full with money, and the Federal Reserve Board fills them up with credit money available to do a big war. Well, that's something like modern monetary theory, because the Federal Reserve Board always creates new money out of really nothing. And just think of it for a minute. If it didn't do that, the economy could never grow. So it creates credit or money that way. And there's a big, they just created $3 trillion to bail out the banks. The European banks are doing a lot of it right now, and so are the Japanese banks, to keep them afloat. Well, applying these things that banking theorists know a lot about, but most citizens don't, in fact, the only way to get the oil companies out of the way, they're the ones who've been blocking good regulations and dealing with climate change, is ultimately to buy them out and get them out of the way. The way to do it is using the modern techniques that are developing monetary theory all over the world. Now, we know that's not going to happen tomorrow, and we published an article in The Nation now saying it's time for everybody to begin to learn about this kind of strategy and develop a clear strategy so that hopefully when the Trump administration is hopefully out of the way in 3.5 years, we have a real program that could move quickly in on the companies, get them out of the way and pass the legislation to deal with climate change. They're the political obstacle. But they may very well not be so unhappy if the continued pressure grows, because the value of their company depends upon how people think about the future of oil. And if they begin to get worried about what's going to happen, their stock values are going down, as Securities and Exchange Commission has been demonstrating almost every day. So that's a little bit of a complicated thing, but there's an article, if you go up to the Nation website archives, we published about 3-4 months ago, laying out the details of this with a view of getting ahead of the game so people begin to think about something really a little bit bold and out of the usual.
It's interesting. Just recently, Exxon's shareholders at their annual meeting passed an initiative requiring the bureaucracy of Exxon to include in their financial statement the effects of climate change and how they are dealing with those effects, which formerly the muckety-mucks in Exxon refused to do. And in spite of the fact that it's well known now that from the 1970s, at least the 1970s on, they were putting resources into studying climate change and the effects of it. So it's really something. And also, this recent ruling by the district judge in the Dakota Access Pipeline that the Energy Transfer's reckless spill record and the failure to do the environmental impact report made it illegal for the pipeline to be happening, you know, being used, although it's still being used. The company's shares fell below $20 per share for the first time. So those are some interesting real-world actions that are being taken out. But I have some questions further about what you're proposing. Who would be buying out the fossil fuel shares? Of course, it wouldn't only be Exxon. It would be other companies. And then who would own them?
Probably the simplest way to do it, I mean, there are many, many possibilities, is for the government itself to buy out Exxon, just as it did with the big banks. It took over the big banks and then gave back during the last crisis. But how would it finance that? It would get the money from the Federal Reserve Board through quantitative easing. That's probably what would happen most directly. And then the idea is to get them out of the way politically so you can pass all sorts of regulations that really get at the climate issues and the carbon, the CO2 issues directly. It's because you got to get them out of the way politically from blocking things as they did in the Senate the last time around during the Obama administration.
Let's run through this to make sure I understand. The Federal Reserve would create money, which they would then buy shares of Exxon or whatever, using that as an example.
The Money Reserve Board would finance the U.S. Treasury, which would then the government would buy up Exxon. The easiest analogy most people have, it's not perfect, is what happens when we go to war, big time, World War II. Somehow money appears out of nowhere to go to war. And all of a sudden, the government's buying ships and tanks and airplanes and bombs and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's not a perfect example and not a perfect analogy, but that's pretty much a good generalization and a general way to think about it without getting deeply into monetary theory. We do think it's important for people to, you know, get ahead of the issue and begin to digest these kinds of ideas so that we can, you know, be in a position to act when we get to the point where action is possible. And that's why we published the article in The Nation a few months ago, way well in advance, even though we're in the midst of the Trump administration.
This gets to a fundamental question which you address in your paper on the pluralistic commonwealth. Culture must be a key part of the pluralist commonwealth. Talk about why that's so important, because I think culture just kind of gets forgotten.
Oh, it's very important. And just let me clarify that the little book is a little booklet. It's kind of a 4x6. We published it as a kind of handbook. And if you go to the website for the Next System Project and look up principles, you'll find it there. People, study groups are forming around it. Activists are interested in it, using it as study guides. So one of the elements, and the book takes up a series of elements, kind of bit by bit by bit, chunk by chunk, like a little encyclopedia, if you like, or a handbook. Culture, the notion, and that quote you read was a really wonderful one, that we have to get beyond simply politics, which is always confrontational and contiguous and litigious as well, and also beyond simply economic institutions like private corporations in capitalism or state-owned companies. We do need different range of them, like cooperatives and community-owned neighborhood development as well. But one of the tests is, are we using and building very practical economic institutions that help people see each other as part of a community? Or are we building institutions that divide us and conquer us rather than help us nurture the ideas that we're in something in common, that we see each other as friends and equals, but also part of a larger commonwealth perspective, the vision of a much different way of thinking about economics, not we're all in it together is the idea. And the most obvious example of that is the garden variety co-op. But there are many other elements that can help create one, create this feeling over time if we make that a priority, if we think about that and begin to think and talk about it and develop it.
In the proposed budget, culture is pretty much non-funded. It's just zeroed out. And we, as a small community radio station, are concerned about that, with the potential zeroing out of our Corporation for Public Broadcasting funds. What can you say in such a time that could give us encouragement?
Well, it is a challenging time, and it's likely to get worse before it gets better. But I think about these things historically, and I mentioned almost every serious historical movement for positive change has experienced really growing difficulty and pain. It's partly what gets us going and gets us moving in a new direction. So I always compare our lives to the lives of people living in Mississippi in the 1930s, when to do anything, there were no resources, great danger, people were actually being killed. But people found a way, because they had a moral and political vision, of laying down the groundwork for something that became extraordinarily important over time. I actually think, and this is one way to think about it, these difficult times we live in, and they're going to get more difficult, I think, rather than less, that this is where the really, really important political work is done, and the economic work and cultural work, beginning now when it's always easy to join a movement when a movement's moving. The really intense questions are, can we begin now? And the good thing to see is that many, many people around the country are developing not only politics and not only confrontation and demonstrations, but there are many, many examples of institutions that build commonwealth and build a culture of community developing in many parts of the country that just don't get covered by the national press. And one of the reasons I wrote this little book, Principles, is to kind of give people leads to the various things that are happening in different parts of the country that can be done anywhere, and it's a matter of rolling up your sleeves and getting on the web and learning about it and getting some friends together and saying, let's do it.
I'm happy to say that our listener area has a very long and, I think, proud history of community organizing. And so I think that your words will reach very fertile ground for that. You develop a term that's new to me, evolutionary reconstruction and displacement of corporate power, and how that differs from countervailing strategy of containment and regulation. Could you expand on that? First of all, what is reconstruction and displacement?
Well, first let me comment on, and I know your area has a wonderful history of activism, so my suggestion always is the way things start is a half a dozen folks get together and they get some pizza and some some beer and read something, and I hope they might read this little book, Principles. That's what it's designed for, activists. And then they decide to do something. So I do think it's really important to think about that. Evolutionary reconstruction is a term that I've kind of coined because I didn't find any words in the dictionary that describe the kind of process that I think is happening around the country, and is a very important process. So in one sense, if you think about revolution, it's kind of overthrowing the existing power structure, and often violently. That's one process of change. Another process of change, which has been the process of liberalism, and I come out of the Wisconsin liberal tradition, but probably moved somewhat beyond it, is you allow the existing structures to stay. For instance, the big corporations, Exxon and the big banks, stay there. And then you try to regulate them and reform them, but you don't change the structure. And that has some weaknesses, as we're beginning to see all along. Evolutionary reconstruction isn't just a term for a third process, which is how do we build up new institutions in the evolutionary form that themselves give us a new direction and can begin to become power bases for the ongoing process of transformation. The obvious example with many, many parts of the country is, rather than private enterprise, the development of cooperatives. In Boulder, Colorado, the development of a publicly owned utility for climate change reasons, which they've just done, taken over the city private one, the evolutionary change in that respect. In Cleveland, there's a really interesting complex of worker-owned companies connected to a neighborhood structure, evolving in a new direction. So it's laying groundwork by actually doing things and building institutions, at the same time doing politics along with the building process. So we need a term for something that's neither violent revolution nor letting the existing institutions, big corporations, stay there and trying to regulate them. How do we build a whole evolving structure that lays the groundwork for the next system or the next society? That's the term. And I do mean, as a historian, systems come and go. I don't think the one we live in is the last system. I actually think we're in a period where, even given all the difficulties, and indeed the difficulties tell you there's something wrong with the system, I think we're laying groundwork for something beyond here, and it's a very, very important period of history at the early stage when the hard work needs to be done in an evolving form. That's the kind of terminology. We need some language for that process.
Okay. I was intrigued about the place that gender equity has in this evolutionary change that you're describing. It goes way beyond just economic justice and even to how we design our towns and cities. Could you expand on that, please?
I'm really glad you raised that question, because it takes you to the notion of changing institutions as well as changing attitudes about discrimination and preference. So, for instance, there is a wonderful woman who is an architectural and city professor at Yale. Her name is Hayden. And she points out, as a number of feminist scholars have pointed out, that the design of cities very often puts the man's job a half-hour drive this way and a woman's job a half-hour drive that way and the kids' school 20 minutes this way and the home another place, so that the physical design of the community prevents even a bringing together of families, let alone bringing together of community structures that could help raise kids as a community process and bring the parents in as part of the community. That is, we live in a society where very often that's not possible, particularly in the bigger cities where the majority of the population now resides. So the question becomes, if you're really interested in gender equality, where both men and women would provide the same amount of time and energy for home care and child care, but also the educational system would be integrated, that would require a bringing together, what Hayden calls the non-sexist city, bringing together folks in a different geographic city planning way of thinking about things. And I think that's a terribly important idea that folks haven't picked up on, but I think it gives you another idea of how one could think about developing a new direction. it's probably a little easier, and I'm from Wisconsin, and some of the smaller cities in Wisconsin, and probably where you folks are as well, but in the big cities where, you know, the bulk, majority of the population lives, some people, it's a two-hour drive to go to work and the back again, and they're all spread out and dispersed, but nobody thinks consciously of this question of how do we change roles and have men and women doing similar roles in the house, in the child rearing. That requires a design that allows for that, a physical design. So I really like Hayden's way of thinking about it, but I haven't seen enough folks pick up on it yet.
Pretty soon it's going to be the 4th of July, and we'll hear lots and lots of shibboleths around liberty and freedom and all that. You have a very interesting take on what liberty actually involves. It goes way beyond just the government leaving one alone. Would you talk about that, please?
It is important to have the government leave you alone, particularly if you're trying to do important things to change the system and the way we're talking about it. But real liberty means that you have a place to stand that gives you security enough to be free to say what you want to say, to do what you want to do. The old idea of conservatives, and I think the left has not dealt with this very well. Conservatives used to argue, not very strongly, but I think, but at least they argued it, that individual private entrepreneurs or farmers had at least had a place to stand that was independent. The populist movement had some of that in it. At least they had a something to stand on, something firm. The small farm was an economic base which gave them a different characterological possibility. The only people who have that kind of possibility now are tenured professors at universities. They can say whatever they want and not get fired, usually, not always, but usually. So that's a basis, an economic basis for real security in order to have real liberty. That's one piece of the puzzle, and we certainly would need that as we develop a vision of a next system that is humane and democratic. The other part of it is, do you have time to do anything? Do you have free time? Are you free or are you compressed because expenses are so high that you have to work on two jobs? Do you have much freedom to do anything but, you know, slave to try to get down to the next minimum wage job? Well, this country is a very rich country. Right now, if you divided the economy up equally, it's about $240,000 for every single family of four, or $120,000 and a 20-hour week for every family of four. There you would have lots of free time if we had a more equitable society. You'd have 20 hours more that you're not forced to labor. So security is one piece. The other piece is time. And the third piece, to come back to your culture question, do you live in a community of support and culture for freedom? Do people support you, even if you do your own thing, to be different, to try new things? Or is it a culture that frowns on experimentation? So culture is a really important part of freedom as well. It's not simply it's very important to have constitutional guarantees. But that's just the opening end of the question of what real freedom and what real liberty could be in the next system. And I think we need to broaden our discussion and understanding of obvious points like the ones I just suggested.
And I was particularly impressed with the part in which you focus on regionalism and how important that is. It so rarely is included in any analysis of what's going on and what needs to happen. Would you talk about that, please?
I'm happy to, and I'm glad you picked up on it, because you're right. Very few people have been really thinking through and talking about the regional question, although I think it's starting, and in the 1930s there was a very powerful debate about it. So one way to get at it is to say, hey, you out there, anybody who believes in participatory democracy, whatever that may mean in your own understanding, can you explain how we can do participatory democracy in a continental system, 3,000 miles corner to corner, with 330 million people? And obviously, as soon as you ask that question, you realize that the country is so big that there would have to be a different design of the system constitutionally if you wanted to get anything like a more participatory vision of democracy. Now, most people say many of the states are too small, either in population or in geography, or there are not enough folks to get a real constitutional group together to handle big economic problems. So there was a long discussion in the 1930s, and I think it's going to be revived now, that something smaller than a continent but bigger than most states is the intermediate unit where decisions could be made. And we call that a region. In the United States, California would be a region. So might New England be a region, where we might think over the long haul, as the population gets bigger, to really decentralize to regions, much decentralization constitutionally if we really want democracy. You folks probably don't realize how, I'm glad to talk with you, because where you live, here's an interesting thing to think about. Germany can be fit within the state of Montana. Most European countries that are democratic are very small compared with the United States. So the idea of something smaller than a continent and bigger than most states would be the appropriate kind of longer-term direction if we really wanted to take democracy seriously.
Our listening area is actually in Northern California in Mendocino County, and there's always talk of the north of California splitting from the south of California. It doesn't really go anywhere, but California is what, the fifth biggest economy in the world? And the culture of the north is very different from the culture of the south, as are the resources and the politics. So I loved the graphic on the part about regionalism, showing the various states grouped as regions, potentially. I appreciated that. Now,
there was a movement, a small movement in the last election, thinking about California as a state, as a freestanding government. But you might think of it as a region, the whole state, rather than dividing it in half, as a probably the most obvious region. New England is another area that you can think about as regional as a whole.
Anyway, we're seeing ourselves as this huge country. There is so much anger at Washington coming from people, particularly in rural areas, and many people believe that's why Trump is our president today. Can you speak to that, the disaffection of people in their locales with D.C.?
Well, I think that they are rightly angered at the locus of power, which is D.C., Washington. And because so much of what happens in Washington on the big issues is, in fact, dominated by elites and big corporations. Take the banking industry. They are up there right now, kind of taking apart the Dodd-Frank regulations. They're always in there on the environmental issues. They're going to cut back on welfare and health care programs. So what goes on in Washington and with the lobbyists, people, I think, are right to have great skepticism about it until we actually kind of roll up our sleeves. And it's going to continue and get worse until we can roll up our sleeves and do better. This little book is part of, you know, a movement that's building up at the grassroots level, but there is an awful lot of action building up. Bernie Sanders might very well have, you know, won the election under other kind of situations had people been aware of how much power was building. And then the next time around, we may see someone like that. So it's not, I am not a pessimist, although times are difficult. The anger at Washington is real. There's a good reason for it. The politics of the current moment is dominated by big money and big corporations. But that's not the end of history. I mean, we've shown that in the last election, that there's a lot of folks who would have gone in a different direction, and maybe by the next time around, we can build up more. But I take a longer view of that. I think to do what we're really talking about, and we talked about culture and new economic institutions, we're talking about the next three decades. And people in it for the long haul and who understand that the kind of change we need is going to take people really thinking through, are they willing to build now and build up over time, thinking about how we actually build up change of the kind that achieved, even the American Revolution or the Civil Rights Movement. Those are all 30, 40-year developmental processes. The feminist movement, the environment, all of those things didn't just happen. They happen because people start saying, well, I'm going to do something about this, even if it's going to take a long time, I'm willing to start. I think that's a very American process. If you stand back for a little bit and don't think you're going to get instant gratification change, and think about how change really occurs in our own lifetime, that's the only way you actually build up enough power and cultural power as well as economic power and political power. It's doing it. So this book is aimed at people who want to think through a different vision beyond capitalism or corporate capitalism, beyond state socialism and start building from the bottom up a different vision, but doing it practically, not doing it pie in the sky, trying to get real about what can be done locally and with in the neighborhood, with co-ops, with public utilities, with the big banking movement is happening. Public banking is now popping up all over the country. 10 years ago, there were no public banks and no public bank activists except one bank 100 years old owned by the state of North Dakota. And now many, many cities, Philadelphia, Santa Fe, Denver, Los Angeles, Oakland, Washington, D.C., are all beginning to build up towards publicly owned banks in order to finance different ways of development in the local cities. So it's another example of people who a decade ago start saying it's time to do something different and are beginning to find lots of folks. When you raise your hand, a lot of folks say, hey, count me in too. So I'm a prudent optimist, even though I think it's going to take a big, long struggle. I think people can actually begin to do that in the United States. Why not? It's been done before.
Well, that gets to what you keep calling the vision, and many people cannot envision anything other than the current system. There seems to be a certain inevitability to it. But in the time of the divine rights of kings, people couldn't imagine anything else then either. So it's so valuable, the work you have been doing your very long life, Gar Alperovitz. I want us to end, since we're running out of time, talking about technology and the seeming supremacy of it in our culture. But the actual, what came before the current situation, it's not just the ingenuity of the tech moguls.
Well, you know, two things can be said. One is the modern computers. Bill Gates was working on a government contract when he developed what became the basis of the vast resources that he put together financially. The internet was a publicly developed kind of institution, which now is central to all the modern technologies. And indeed, if you look here and there, many, many things the public actually financed and ought to be benefiting from rather than the other way around. The other thing to say about technology is, you know, it's going to make possible huge amounts of free time if we do our politics right. The country is so rich, $240,000 for every family of four if you divide it. It's going to go up to $1 million for every family of four, or 20-hour work week and $500,000, or, you know, this is well within the technological forecast of the next decades, or a 10-hour week and $250,000 if the politics begins to redistribute both time and money. So technology's on our side if we know how to build the politics to develop what could be done in this extremely rich country.
That requires the redistribution of wealth, and we are currently in the process of undoing. When I say we, I don't mean you and I, Gar. I mean the minions of the richest, wealthiest people on the planet, not just in D.C., but all around the world. Do you have any sense of how actual redistribution of that wealth could occur?
Well, there's two ways to think about it. One is this process just below the radar of all these institutions being built up around the country, and the book covers a lot of them. But the other thing people to keep in mind is, think about who came out for Bernie Sanders. Totally unexpected. And that was, for a long time, this was something that nobody had done any developmental work for. It's not an easy task, but I don't think they've got all the cards. So simply, as I used to work in the House and Senate for Wisconsin Democrats and senators, I don't think politically the people who are in charge right now have got all the cards at all. I think Bernie Sanders and the next people who can activate are going to be able to do an awful lot, and partly because the pain level is going to increase because of the current government. So viewing things historically rather than, oh, it's going to happen tomorrow, I think now's the time to lay groundwork both for a new politics but also for the new institutions that help build a different culture of the kind that we're talking about and what this little book is kind of written for. The way to start is the way the women's movement started. Call six friends together, get a copy of this book or another book, start reading and thinking, what can we do here to build? And I think that's the way every movement gets going. It starts locally with people deciding to do something.
We're going to have to leave it there. I thank you so much for joining us today on Forthright Radio, Professor Gar Alperovitz, and for the many decades of your long, long life that you have devoted to thinking of these things and helping us to envision a more equitable future. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. I much appreciate it.
Our guest today on Forthright Radio has been Professor Gar Alperovitz. We have been discussing Principles of a Pluralist Commonwealth, which can be read for free online at thenextsystem.org. Another resource of his co-creation is the democracycollaborative.org. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Rich Culbertson. I'm Joy LeClaire.